Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Our Torah portion today, we are in Yitro, Exodus chapter 18. This course covers obviously the giving of the Ten Commandments, which is Exodus 20. It ends in Exodus 20, verse 23, then chapter 20. Jethro, the minister of Midian, the father-in-law of Moses, heard everything that God did to Moses and to Israel, his people. The Jehovah had taken Israel out of Egypt. Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, took Zipporah, the wife of Moses, after she had been sent away, and her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom, for he had said, I was a sojourner in a strange land. The name of the other was Eleazar, for the God of my father came to my aid, and he saved me from the sword of Pharaoh. Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, came to Moses with his sons and his wife into the wilderness where he was encamped by the mountain of God. He said to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, have come to you with your wife and her two sons with her. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he prostrated himself and kissed him, and each inquired about the other's well-being. Then came to the tent. Moses told his father-in-law everything that Jehovah had done to Pharaoh and Egypt for Israel's sake, all the travail that had befallen them on the way, and that Jehovah had rescued them. Jethro rejoiced over all the good that Jehovah had done to it for Israel, that he had rescued it from the hand of Egypt. Jethro said, Blessed is Jehovah who rescued you from the hand of Egypt and from the hand of Pharaoh, who has rescued the people from under the hand of Egypt. Now I know that Jehovah is greater than all the gods, for in the very matter with which the Egyptians had conspired against them. Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, took a burnt offering and a feast offering for God, and Aaron and all the elders of Israel came to eat bread with the father-in-law of Moses before God. It was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning until evening. The father-in-law of Moses saw everything that he was doing to the people. He said, What is this thing that you do to the people? Why do you sit alone with all the people standing by you from morning to evening? Moses said to his father-in-law, Because the people come to me to seek God. When they have a matter, one comes to me, and I judge between a man and his fellow, and I make known the decrees of God and his teachings. The father-in-law of Moses said to him, The thing that you do is not good. You will surely become worn out, you as well as this people that is with you, for this matter is too hard for you. You will not be able to do it alone. Now heed my voice. I shall advise you, and may God be with you. You be a representative to God, and you convey the matters to God. You shall caution them regarding the decrees and the teachings, and you shall make known to them the path in which they should go and the deeds that they should do. You should discern from among them the entire people, men of accomplishment, God-fearing people, men of truth, people who despise money. And you shall appoint them as leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, and leaders of fifties, and leaders of tens. They shall judge the people at all times. They shall bring every major matter to you, and every minor matter they shall judge, and it will be eased for you. They shall bear with you. If you do this thing, and God shall command you, then you will be able to endure, and this entire people as well shall arrive at its destination in peace. Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did everything that he had said. Moses chose men of accomplishment from among all Israel and appointed them heads of the people, leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, and leaders of tens. They judged the people at all times. The difficult thing they would bring to Moses, and the minor thing they themselves would judge. Moses sent off his father-in-law, and he went to his land. chapter 19. In the third month, from the exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt, on this day they arrived at the wilderness of Sinai. They journeyed from Rephidim and arrived at the wilderness of Sinai and encamped in the wilderness, and Israel encamped there, opposite of the mountain. Moses ascended to God, and Jehovah called to him from the mountain, saying, "So shall you say the house of Jacob and relate the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to Egypt and what I have borne you on the wings of eagles and brought you to me. And now, if you hearken well to me and observe my covenant, you shall be to me the most beloved treasure of all peoples, for mine is the world. You shall be to me a kingdom of ministers and a holy nation. These the words you'll speak, the children of Israel." Moses came and summoned the elders of the people and put before them all these words that Jehovah had commanded him. The entire people responded together and said, "Everything that Jehovah has spoken, we shall do." Moses brought back the words, the people, to Jehovah. Jehovah said to Moses, "Behold, I come to you in the thickness of the cloud, so the people will hear as I speak to you, and they will also believe in you forever." Moses related these words, the people, to Jehovah. Jehovah said to Moses, "Go to the people, sanctify them today and tomorrow, and they shall wash their clothing. Let them be prepared for the third day. For on the third day, Jehovah will descend in the sight of the entire people on Mount Sinai. You shall set boundaries to the people round about, saying, 'Beware of ascending the mountain or touching its edge. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely die. A hand shall touch it, for he shall surely be stoned or thrown down. Whether animal or person, he shall not live. Upon an extended blast of shofar, they may ascend the mountain.'" Moses descended from the mountain to the people, and he sanctified the people, and they washed their clothing. He said to the people, "Be prepared after a three-day period. Do not draw near a woman." On the third day, when it was morning, there was thunder and lightning, and a heavy cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the blast was very powerful. The entire people that was in the camp shuddered. Moses brought the people forth from the camp toward God, and they stood at the bottom of the mountain. All of Mount Sinai was smoking because Jehovah had descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of the furnace, and the entire mountain shuddered exceedingly. The sound of the blast grew continually much stronger. Moses would speak, and God would respond to him with a voice. Jehovah descended upon the Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and Jehovah summoned Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses ascended. Jehovah said to Moses, "Descend. Warn the people, lest they break through to Jehovah to see, and a multitude of them will fall. Even the Kohanim who approach Jehovah should be prepared, lest Jehovah burst forth against them." Moses said to Jehovah, "The people cannot ascend Mount Sinai, for you have warned us, saying, 'Bound the mountain and sanctify it.'" Jehovah said to him, "Go, descend. Then you shall ascend with Aaron with you. But the Kohanim and the people, they shall not break through to ascend to Jehovah, lest he bursts forth against them." Jehovah descended to the people and said to them. God spoke all these statements, saying, "I am Jehovah your God, who has taken you out of the land of Egypt to the house of slavery. You should not recognize the gods of others in my presence. You should not make for yourselves a carved image or any likeness of that which is in the heavens above or on the earth below or in the water beneath the earth. You should not prostrate yourselves to them nor worship them, for I am Jehovah your God, a jealous God, who visits the sin of the fathers upon the children to the third and the fourth generations for my enemies, but who shows kindness for thousands to those who love me and observe my commandments. You should not take the name of Jehovah your God in vain, for Jehovah will not absolve anyone who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. 6 days shall you work and accomplish all your work, but the seventh day is Sabbath to Jehovah your God. You should not do any work. You, your son, your daughter, your slave, your maidservant, your animal, your convert within your gates. For in 6 days Jehovah made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, Jehovah blessed the Sabbath day and sanctified it. Honor your father and your mother so that your days will be lengthened upon the land that Jehovah your God gives to you. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your fellow. You shall not covet your fellow's house. You shall not covet your fellow's wife, his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, nor anything belongs to your fellow. The entire people saw the thunder and the flames, the sound of the blast, and the smoking mountain. The people saw and trembled and stood from afar, and they said to Moses, "You speak to us, and we shall hear. Let God not speak to us, lest we shall die." Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, for in order to elevate you has God come, so that awe of him should be upon your faces, so that you shall not sin." The people stood from afar, and Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. Jehovah said to Moses, "So shall you say the children of Israel, you have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You shall not make images what is of me. Gods of silver, gods of gold, you shall not make for yourselves. An altar of earth shall you make for me, and you shall slaughter near it your burnt offerings, and your peace offerings, your flock and your herd. Wherever I permit my name to be mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. And when you make for me an altar of stones, do not build them with hewn, for you will have raised your sword over it and desecrated the stone. You shall not ascend my altar on steps, that your nakedness will not be uncovered upon it." That was the Torah portion of Yitro. That is Exodus 18 through 20. I have tons of stuff to talk about regarding this Torah portion. There's a slight chance we actually get to most of it. But before I go there, any basic questions that will be too extensive about this Torah portion for Yitro? This course, obviously, Exodus from Moses' father-in-law through giving the Ten Commandments. Comments, questions, opinions, ideas? Yes, Anne.
Yes. There was an agreement already before going into the going up the mountain. Is that to be considered the first covenant?
Agreement. Sorry, explain your question. Like, so okay. You're referring to the fact that they couldn't go up the mountain yet. That part of the agreement, or what?
No, the people said they would do everything.
Oh, right. Yes. So that agreement is a important component, or important step. So that's it. Chapter 19, verse, was it 5 or so? Let's see. 19, verse, I think it's verse 4 or 5. Let's see here. So God is speaking. So this part of the agreement happens prior to God giving the instructions, or the 10 basic commandments, 10 major instructions. Now, to be fair, these 10 instructions are not all inclusive. They themselves are like headlines to the actual details of each individual law, which we'll discuss throughout the rest of the Torah. But in this instance, when God talks to Moses, is that you will say it, you will tell these things to the people. Verse 5, "If you hearken to me well, observe my covenant, you shall be with to me the most beloved treasure of peoples, for the mind is the entire world. You shall be a kingdom of priests or ministers and a holy nation. These which speak to the children of Israel." Of course, Moses relays that to him, and they agree. So that agreement happens prior to God listing, this is how you're going to live. So the people have already went through the 10 plagues, and went through the Red Sea. They went through the experiences of the manna and the quail and everything else. They saw the power of God already. They now have a general idea of who and what he was. Note that you will, if you've noticed, maybe you have or haven't, I'm not sure. When God introduces himself most often, he tells, "Hey, I'm the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt," as opposed to saying, "I'm the God of the whole world," like we do today. Most Jewish prayers are Olam, meaning the universe, the whole world, the God of the world, the God of the universe. He focuses himself, no, not that he isn't those things, but he focuses himself attention, "I am the one who you know personally in the form of the one who brought you out of Egypt, the one you saw, the great things that I did." It's important to note that God focuses that attention on that, because that's what we can relate to. I can relate to something that I can see, that I can feel, I can touch, I can experience. To think he's a God who created, the Orion, that means dilly squat to me. I don't live there, I live here. There's a bunch of stars in the sky. It doesn't mean anything. However, the God who did something miraculous for me and my family that I experienced, I remember that. And every other human that I've ever met is the same. We know what we experience because our life is based on what we experienced, what we lived through, the things that God did or didn't do along our path. And we remember, yeah, that's what God did, or this is what I have done in my past and how God corrected me. The various things, that's how we experience our God. So he makes a point to notice that's the type of God that he introduced himself to as well as they give the people, hey, here's my agreement. Agree to it, yes or no. They say, yes, we want this agreement. We want to do this. Great, here are the Ten Commandments. Here's my instructions on how to live. All right. Any comments or questions? Yes, Jared.
No, I just like seeing Jeff run back and forth.
I'm sure you do.
I just like to notice that when Jethro said, find men who are accomplished, who don't seek unfair gain, and those other two fingers that you have.
Yeah. He gave four requirements, yes.
He only found men who were of
accomplished.
Right. So
yes, it's an important thing to note. Jethro gave a requirement of the men he was specifying. He gave four requirements that Jethro listed off, things that he wanted. Moses found men that accomplished one of them. So it implies that Moses was not either able or willing or whatever, or couldn't find men who could fulfill all four requirements. Which is interesting because those four requirements, what Jethro said, these are standard things you would want for a judge. Because accomplishment, the term accomplishment, is men who are in charge of or over something. That doesn't mean that they're a good person. There are good politicians. I think they're good politicians somewhere. And there's bad ones too, lots of those. So just because you're an accomplished person, you're over something, doesn't make you a good individual. You could be just as rotten. I'm sure there's got to be some good ones, but not many. Yes.
Well, there is a God, and there's a second witness in 2 Peter 2:9. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust to the day of judgment to be punished. So God probably directed, I'm sure, Moses which ones to choose that were godly men that could lead the people.
So it's interesting. So we find out later some of the identities of some of those individuals. As it lists later on in the book of Exodus, as well as repeats certain individuals in Numbers as well. And of course, obviously we know the 10 spies and such. The individuals selected for heads of their households, the major heads of households, in particular when Moses takes the census and lists people by name, although we don't have all their names, he writes down everybody's name, which is important to note that he did so. And he appoints as heads of entire tribes and individual families within each tribe. He lists their names. So note who Moses selected. And note, even though Moses selected them at this time, it appears, or either at this time or later on when a similar event happens with Moses and he talks to God and God tells him the same thing Jethro just told him. The similar type of event when God selects 70 individuals at that time. Those individuals, God winds up killing almost all of them. The 40 years of wilderness. Remember? They all die. So even though Moses may have selected the best there was, I use the term very loosely, best, they weren't all that great. So there was still a distinct failure within inside the individuals that Moses either didn't have better ones, or whatever reason, I don't know. But either way, they still all end up dying in the wilderness, with the exception, of course, with Joshua and Caleb. But those are the two distinctions. And we don't know about the women, but we know at least the males. So even though Moses selected the best he could, God may have said, hey, pick this guy and this guy and this guy. And even God put his spirit upon 70 of them later on. They still weren't that great. And God still says, yeah, you're all trash. I'm discarding all of you. I'll take with your kids instead. So it's a hard thing in Moses' instance to try to find someone to fulfill all four requirements. And apparently, it doesn't look like he did. He couldn't find somebody who could do all four. Except, of course, Aaron himself and Caleb and Joshua. Any comments or questions regarding this Torah portion so far? Well, lots of different things to talk about. So, all right, we'll just jump into this. Okay. There's a few things to point out to you. Now, these are subtle things. I'm going to skim through chapter 18 and 19 to focus more of my attention on the commandments themselves, which is interesting in its own right. So first of all, there's much debate regarding certain events, certain occurrences, and how they occurred. Obviously, we can tell by the sheer words told to us. We've mentioned this many times already. Chapter 18 of Exodus happens after chapter 20, or chapter 19, I should say, after 19. So Jethro's probably there for the Ten Commandments reading, but the events in 18, of course, occur after chapter 19. Just because they are written chronologically has nothing to do with what actually occurs. That's a loose thing. These are event-based topics. We know that because Jethro shows up when they're camped in the mountain of God, but they haven't reached there yet until chapter 19. So we know that Jethro comes, they're at the camp of the mountain of God, as chapter 18 records, but they don't actually arrive there yet until a chapter later. So the orientation, the topics are swapped because God intended to have this topic listed first. For whatever reason, it doesn't really matter, but that's what he did. Within this topic, what I want to bring to your attention is this is a strange translation. Most of you probably have the same translation in your books. I can't say that it's right or wrong, just that it is strange. In the phrase there of chapter 18, verse 3, this is verse 3. Verse 2. It says, Jethro, the father of Moses, took Zipporah, the wife of Moses, after she'd been sent away. The last time we interacted with Zipporah was the circumcision that occurred, and she threw the foreskin at Moses' feet and said, "Your husband of blood to me." The last time that we hear about her until now. The phrase sent her away throughout your Bibles is the word used for divorce. That's what the word is. Which one? When he said verse 2 of chapter 18. The word there, it says, verse 2 of chapter 18. Jethro, father of Moses, took Zipporah, the wife of Moses, quote, after she had been sent away. The phrase sent away is in your Torah translated everywhere else as divorced. So that's the normal translation. Now, whatever reason, if chosen, and if you were just reading straight Hebrew text, you would just read past that after you divorced and you kept on reading, you wouldn't think twice about it. But that's how the word is. But in this particular instance, they chose the English to sent away. Maybe they had a good feeling toward Moses or not. I don't know. I don't know if he actually officially divorced her or not. But either way, that's what the phrase means. So he brought her back. Because when you send your wife away to divorce, the Torah actually explains she goes back to her father's household, which is what she did with her sons. Of course, his sons went with her. And then, of course, he brings them back. We do not know for certain if it was, in fact, a divorce. But that's how you used to divorce people prior to the Torah's instructions. Because the Torah gives a requirement for divorce. What is the requirement for divorce in our Torah? And remember what the requirement is? It's a piece of paper. What's paper mean? Here's your bill, a receipt, a citation of divorcement. Prior to the piece of paper given to you, you're not officially divorced. That's what Torah, that's what the instructions are. However, prior to that instruction, if a man sends his wife out of the house, kicks her out, sends her away, as this phrase, that means he has divorced her. That's the official term at the time. So things have changed, of course. So we don't know for certain if Moses actually divorced her or not, but the phrase there implies he did. And is that relevant? Maybe not. It's on your personal opinion whether it's relevant. And the fact that we're not sure, he obviously remarries another person later after many, many years go by. She may or may not be still alive. I don't know because it's a poor. I'm not sure how old she was when they had children. But the two children of Moses, however, stay with him. So regardless of whether or not he remarries her or she was just temporarily out of his presence, the family stays with. His father-in-law, of course, leaves and goes back to his own home. I'm going to skim through this a few more details until I get to chapter 20. These are minor things. Let's see. We'll jump past. I'm going to skip some stuff here. There's a few things about the messianic prophecies and such. So one of the topics that Jethro brings up, and God, of course, reiterates the same thing when he anoints the 70 men. When it comes to a messianic or deliverer, as Moses is supposed to be a messianic figure, that we would it would implies or instructs that when Messiah is back or comes back or is here on earth or is ruled over the earth, the same format will be applied. So we as individuals will be captains, use the term loosely, captains or instructors over tens and hundreds and thousands and such as nations, which is what he did when he anointed his 12 apostles, as he selected those 12 individuals as be individuals who were in charge of the 12 tribes of Israel. So he already did that, and it was doing that in the process while he was on earth. And the extension is, can you want that the Messiah will do so again in more great detail? Let's see here. Other things I rattle off to you that were relatively minor. One of the components is, of course, this taking place of the Ten Commandments is traditionally associated with Shavuot. Shavuot, of course, being roughly around between the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th day of the third month, as you use that general ballpark. Today, it's fixed to Sivan 6, but it could officially technically float. And that is the Shavuot, the Ten Commandments, given the Ten Commandments at that time. So these Ten Commandments are typically read during Shavuot because that was the primary event. I have a question for you, though. Actually, I have two questions for you. I'll see if you guys can answer these or not. They're not necessarily simple ones. They're things just to think about. In verse 22 of chapter 19, he repeats it a few times. Well, chapter 21 says, Jehovah said to Moses, descend, warn the people, lest they break through to Jehovah and see the multitude of them will fall. Even the Kohanim who approach Jehovah should be prepared, lest Jehovah burst forth against them. The priests, what priests? They didn't have any yet. What priests? Aaron wasn't even selected. Jethro, maybe you could argue Jethro as a priest of Midian. Right, and that was acceptable. That's true too. It could be the phrase here, priests. It does question as far as is it an allusion to what's going to happen and the God selecting the priests and Levites, but it has not done so yet, or because the Torah is not chronological, it's subtopic matter. Is there some indication that they already know priests are going to be selected or have been set aside? We do know that God did sanctify the firstborn after Egypt, so that much. And typically in pagan cultures at the time, firstborn typically were the priests of your families. That's usually how you operated. So it's conceivable that God was implying or that the Torah implies that group. But it is a curiosity as far as what priests he's referring to. Because Aaron and Levites have not been selected as priests of anything at this time. The other question I have for you is a tense identification. Most of the time when God speaks to Moses... Oh, sorry, go ahead. Your hand was up. Anne.
So the word priest in the Hebrew was Kohen?
Yes. Yes.
So I thought maybe it had been misinterpreted.
No, it's Kohen. This Kohenim, it is the official word for priests. The other question I have for you is we typically imagine when God speaks to Moses that God gives him a verbal yada yada yada, what he's going to say. Then Moses relays the same concept to people to get the message out. You'll notice the majority of the time when God speaks to Moses, he uses the personal pronouns, I. Well, in this instance, when Moses relays the information to people, quoting God, he says he. It's only done a few times in your Tanakhs. The Moses does a couple of times, not often, that he changes personal pronouns around. There are some instances where Moses refers to God, and it's Moses who actually is talking about himself. There's some instances when Moses refers to God in a second or a third person indication. And the only time which Moses gets in trouble for it is when he strikes a rock. He wasn't supposed to speak to it. The only time he actually gets in trouble for it is, you did not sanctify God's name. So it's an interesting scenario which God seems to have, we've talked about this before, that God seems to have leniency on certain things with Moses when he goes through and walks about and changing and interchanging personal pronouns when he's speaking about God or speaking referring him to him by other people. But as time progresses with Moses, it starts changing. God becomes more stringent on identifying personal pronouns, who is actually doing what. God becomes more stringent with Moses. It's interesting to note because anytime I see that, it's okay, why? It's a question with my own head. At what threshold point did God say, Moses, I'm now going to hold you to personal pronoun rule, but I'm not going to at a certain time? So what was the event in Moses' life that God triggered that switch? He triggers the switch, not yet, because this time north, or even beyond the time with the golden calf, Moses is still allowed to use God, I, referring to himself, Moses, and be able to use God's name and use God's personal pronoun at times, even though God himself didn't say to do certain things. But later on, as Moses progresses in time toward the end of 40 years, God becomes more stringent on his instructions for personal pronouns. And that's hence we get the term when God introduced his name, which we use, in English, the I am name, the famous I am name, right? The whole phrase of who was, is, and such and such. But Hebrew, we pronounce it as Yehovah, instead of I am, Yehovah means, it's a contraction frame, but it means he is. Because I am would be referring to me, Daniel, as opposed to Yehovah means he is, the God, referring to the alternative person, the other person. It's a phrase, which is interesting, that God eventually does, because when he tells Moses, this is my name, and God speaking the first person, referring to himself, Moses introduces him to people, he refers to the he as the individual, that person over there, instead of the I. It's a funny thing, but personal pronouns to God, I personally, it's something that I catches my attention. Okay, that's the fun, interesting stuff. So, Ten Commandments. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Okay, so in English we have pronouns, but I mean, does Hebrew really have pronouns?
It does. It has pronouns too. They are not necessarily the beginning of words. They usually can be either the end. They change whether it's the beginning, a vav, or a head. They can change personal pronouns, but they do have personal pronouns. They don't have the proper state of active being words, which that messes things up, but in English. But they do have personal pronouns. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, it's just always one fun way to remember it is, who is he and he is who?
Yes. All right. So before I go, any questions so far regarding Jethro and leading up? Because Ten Commandments is going to be an extensive study for the next hour, or 40 minutes or so. Because Ten Commandments, there's a lot of stuff here. We're not covering everything. It's impossible. We're covering a lot of it in a brief form. Yes. I'm sorry. Say it again.
Does Zipporah's name have a meaning?
Oh, it does, but I've forgotten what it was. I looked it up last year, and I forget what it was this year. Zipporah. What was that?
Bird.
Bird. Thank you. Thank you. That's right. Bird. Yes. I had forgotten. That's right. Balak, King Balak is the name of his dad. That's right. Balak, Zippor. Yeah, it's a little word. All right, so Ten Commandments, chapter 20. So obviously the first commandment, of course, identifies God and who God is. I mentioned before that God identifies himself not as a great creator of all things, but rather introduces himself as the one who brought about the land of Egypt. I mentioned it before because the land of Egypt is what they personally experience. You know God by your experiences, not by what somebody told you or thought of or thinks about from some grand scale thing, an abstract idea. We know God by what we experience in our lives, much like you know your life by what you lived through it. I cannot relate to the life of somebody in Timbuktu, nowhere, other side of the world. I didn't live it. I do relate my own life, what I did live. So God relates to us in the life that we live. In this case, the life of Egypt, where they went through the house of bondage. You should not recognize other gods in my presence. So this is an interesting issue as far as the nature of being in his presence. God being the God of actions, essentially, not a God of an abstract idea, in his presence, something is directly before him or in front of him. Note that the apostles point out the same problem in the concept of a Greek idea of a God and the Hebrew idea of a God. They are not the same. The Greek idea is a theoretical concept of God. The Israelite or Hebrew idea is one that you can physically touch, feel, and experience. Hence, they point out that one looks for miracles, one looks for the ideas of wisdom or concepts. These are two different worlds. They do not speak the same language, even though they may have the same words. They don't mean the same thing. They view the world differently. So in Israel or Hebrew world, you experience God. You don't think about him. You experience him. Greek world, you think about God. You don't say you have to experience him. There are two different ways of looking at it. So in the case of our Tanakh, we will always exclusively find God as a experience. When God remembers someone, for example, and says, I remembered them in Egypt. Well, look, what did he do when he remembered? He remembered them and gave them Moses. He's one which you experience. He did something with that. Yes, Tammy.
Quite frankly, the Greek gods were not the kind of people you wanted to experience.
Probably true.
It usually go well for the people who did end up facing up, like Zeus, for example, was, right. You know, pillaging women all the time. You didn't want to experience right.
him. Good point. The Greek gods are actually, many of them are akin to animals in their nature. So it's an interesting point, but that's how our God experience or wants us to understand him as. So recognizing other gods in my presence. So if you're supposed to focus your attention upon a God that you experience and you instead recognize something else that is not him, but you think it's him, are you experiencing him or something else? You think, let me say that again. You experience something, you think it's from God, but it actually isn't. You don't know that yet. So are you experiencing God, his presence with you, or something else? Well, clearly it's something else. So we have to discern what is God and what isn't God. What is the experience with God? What is your relationship with him and what is not your relationship with him? Hence, I want to bring this idea of the requirement number two. The commandment number two, of course, you should not make for yourself a carved image or likeness of that which is in the heavens above, nor the earth below, the water beneath the earth. You shall not prostrate yourself to them, nor worship them, for I am Jehovah your God, a jealous God who visits the sin of the fathers upon the third and fourth generations of my enemies, but those who kindness for thousands of those who love and observe me in my commandments. Rectify this problem. If God says he visits the sin of the fathers, the one which we are supposed to understand, upon the third and fourth generations, but shows kindness to those who love him for thousands, whether it's generations or people, it doesn't make a difference. Rectify that with Ezekiel chapter 18. Go to Ezekiel 18. Ezekiel 18 is an interesting chapter. It's what I refer to frequently because it's an interesting chapter. It's a conceptual idea that changes, I guess you'd say, as the culture shifted. So Ezekiel 18, God is sending a message to Ezekiel through this chapter as far as what his version of visiting sin upon the children of the fathers, the third and fourth generation, compared to thousands of those who love him. So Ezekiel 18, it says, the word of Jehovah came to me saying, why do you relate this parable upon the land of Israel, saying the fathers eat sour grapes, but the teeth of the sons are set on edge? As I live, the word of the Lord Jehovah, I swear there will be no longer anyone among you who uses this parable in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine. Like the soul of the father, so is the soul of the son. They are mine. The soul that sins, it shall die. If a man is righteous and practices righteousness and justice righteousness, he does not partake of idolatrous sacrifices upon the mountains, does not lift his eyes toward idols, the house of Israel, does not defile his neighbor's wife, nor approach an impure woman, does not oppress any man, returns a collateral for a debt, does not rob any loot, gives his bread to the hungry and covers the naked with clothing, does not give loans with usury or take interest, withholds his hand from corruption, executes true justice between man and man, goes according to my decrees and observes my ordinance to practice truth, he is a righteous man. He shall surely live. The word of Jehovah has spoken. If he begets a violent son who sheds blood, who does any of these sins to his brother, or who does not do all these good deeds, for he even partakes of idolatrous sacrifices upon the mountains, defiles his neighbor's wife, oppresses the poor and the needy, robs the loot, does not return the collateral, lifts his eyes toward the idols, commits abomination, gives loans with usury, and takes interest. Should he live? He shall not live. He has committed all these abominations. He shall surely die. His blood will be upon himself. If he begets a son who sees all the sins of his father that he had done, he sees but does not do the acts like them. He does not partake of idolatrous sacrifices upon the mountains, does not lift his eyes toward the idols of the house of Israel, does not defile his neighbor's wife, does not oppress any man, does not keep collateral, does not rob or loot, gives his bread to the hungry, and covers the naked with the clothing, withholds his hand from harming the poor, does not take usury or interest, obeys my ordinances and follows my decrees, he shall not die for his father's iniquity. He shall surely live. So in Ezekiel 18, this continues on, I'm not done yet. Ezekiel 18 points out the father's eating sour grapes, son set on edge, the introductory of that of this parable. Meaning the father screws up, does something wrong, whatever it is, and the sons are afraid of what the recipient, what they're receiving, the consequence of their father's actions, the phrase means. The father eats sour grapes, the son's teeth are set on edge. They're the ones in fear, or the edge, or the teeth are chattering and being afraid of. Well, God's pointing out that no, that's not the case. The father's righteous, the son is not. The son's punished, father's not. And vice versa. And the father's unrighteous, the son is. The father's punished, the son is not. So rectify that, if you will, attempt if you can. The instructions for the, there is a way to rectify it, by the way, to make sure there is an answer, with the commandment that God says, I will curse those who curse me, sin against me, against it to the third and fourth generations. Rectify that with what's written here in Ezekiel 18. What does that mean? How can God curse someone or extend the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generations in his commandments, but then at the same time tell Ezekiel, that's not true. I don't do it that way. I don't make the son pay for the sins of the father. What's God trying to tell us? What does that mean? Is it contradictory? There really isn't. That's okay. In case you're curious. What's going on in here? What is God trying to relate to us? Help us to understand. Now, in Ezekiel's time, of course, he himself is a captive and sent off to Babylon somewhere. So he's in the middle of nowhere. He himself, mind you, is experiencing, along with all of the other people that were captives, the, quote, sins the fathers, end of quote, as being captives taken over and put off into Babylon. So he is one who is experiencing the sins of his ancestors, including his own generation's sins. They're all being captive and taken. They were all taken away. So he is a recipient of the sins of the fathers, a consequence the fathers have done. And God's saying, oh, no, I don't make the sons pay for the father's sins. The father's supposed to pay for it. So what's going on here? Yes, Anne.
There is none that is righteous, no, not one.
Right, there isn't. So what's happening in this story? So we're all guilty of something, but are we all guilty of the same punishment for different crimes? No, we'd normally be. So what is actually happening? Yes, Jeff.
Could the answer be in the stranger who sojourns among us?
That's an interesting question. So in the case of Jeremiah discusses this, I forgot which chapter it is. Maybe it's supposed to remember, I don't remember. You yourself, your job as a human being scattered around the whole world, wherever you may be, is to pray for the peace of the country that you're in. Because if you pray for the peace of the country that you're in, as Jeremiah points out, you yourself will have peace because your country has peace. So even though you yourself may live in a country that is horrible, you pray for the peace of that country that you yourself has peace because that's where you happen to live. So the nature of Ezekiel, he was living prior to his exile in the area of Judah and Jerusalem. But was Judah and Jerusalem at peace with God? No, they weren't. So in God not being at peace with the nation of Judah, the nation of Judah is not at peace, and that means individuals, though they may be righteous or unrighteous, makes no difference. They are not at peace. Now, Ezekiel was so kind to relay this. I mean, Jeremiah did. I think Jeremiah said it. I can't remember. One of them two said it. And that God gave prophecies. There is two bowls of figs in front of you. There's a bowl of figs that are rotten and unfit to eat, and there's a bowl of figs that are clean and healthy and good to eat. And tells Jeremiah, the figs are good and healthy to eat, when they're desirable, sweet, and ready to consume. I'm going to take out of Judah and place them way over here and drop them off in Babylon. The ones that are unfit to eat, disgusting, only good for throwing out, I am leaving here in Judah to be crushed, destroyed, and ruined. So, using that prophecy, God recites that three times he lists that exact phrase over and over again, referring to people of Judah being plucked out, those who are worth something, that are valuable, that are good, and being moved way over here to the country of being set. Meanwhile, God comes back and then crushes those who are left and destroys them, burns them, and kills them all off. So then we ask ourselves, okay, Ezekiel, then when I think of you being in exile, kicked out of Jerusalem and sent over here as a punishment, is it actually a punishment? No, it's the opposite. So although Ezekiel experienced, along with all of Judah, experienced the exiles being sent out, that was not a punishment against them. The ones God left behind, which Jeremiah records it very in great detail, are massively slaughtered because of their wickedness and their evil ways. And though Jeremiah is left there to tell them, hey guys, knock it off, knock it off, knock it off, they don't stop. They maintain their evil ways because they enjoy it. And that's what they've always done, what they like to do. So God picked them up, those who were valuable, those who were good, and transfer them over to keep them safe. So though Ezekiel experienced the exile and didn't like it, that wasn't a punishment on his part to receive his punishment of his fathers. Rather, he was being pulled out and protected from what God was going to do to his fathers, the father's household. Make sense? So the sin was still cast upon the fathers. The sons were just pulled out. Those were good. Were pulled out and set aside. I'm not saying every human that was captive was good. The point is that's the imagery that God gave us through, it was Jeremiah who did it, regarding the sins, regarding the figs. So now let's see if we can rectify that with the commandment that God does not sin, not put the sin upon the fathers from the sons and vice versa, with the Ten Commandments, the commandment that God says, I will visit the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. Did Ezekiel experience the consequences of the father's sins? Yes. Now, the consequences being the fathers in Judah were corrupt and evil and did horrible things. The consequences were Judah gets destroyed. That is a consequence of their sins. So the experience Ezekiel lives through isn't the destruction part, but the consequence he has to experience is the removal temporarily out of the scene, dropped off in Babylon. So he has now received the consequence is not the death penalty that his fathers receive, but rather the consequence of the actions required that he's going to experience so that God can actually officially crush the sin that is within inside Judah. That's how we get our experience of God saying, I visit the sin of the fathers to third and fourth generation. I mean, they will receive the consequence, not of a death penalty necessarily, but the negative effects of what that father does. Or in this case, many fathers, many generations do. You don't receive the actual direct punishment of a crushing of yourself, but you experience a consequence of it. As we've mentioned this in times past, many times, it's no different than a son having a father who is in prison. The father, however, did the crime. He is in prison. He is paying for it. What's the son's consequence? The absence of a father. That may or may not be a good thing, depending on what kind of father he was. But the absence of father is the son's consequence. The son, however, was not sent to prison with the father, unless, of course, you're in North Korea. That's an important problem. North Korea is the exception to the rule. But the father sent the son separately. They didn't get to go to prison as a father. That was not their payment, not their punishment. The father experienced punishment of going to prison. But the son had the consequence of not having a father as a result to raise him or teach him what is good and right. That's where we get our idea of how we answer this question regarding what's the nature of God speaking. Now, there's more to Ezekiel 18. I may get to it later. We'll see, because it comes up later in other portions, or other commandments. Let's see here. The other part I want to bring to you, the second commandment, is 1 Samuel 15. So if you're 1 Samuel 15, regarding this is all commandment number 2. 1 Samuel 15, I'll find it real quick here. 1 Samuel 15, verse 22 and 23. So 1 Samuel 15, verse 22 and 23. So this is the middle, jumping in the middle of a story. Saul was originally, the king Saul was sent out to go kill a bunch of Amalekites. He killed everybody except the king Agag, as well as all the nice animals he thought were pretty and good to eat. So he failed to do his instruction as Samuel told him to do, but this is what he did. And so Samuel shows up, says, "What have you done? This is not right. You're supposed to kill everybody. God commanded that the Amalekites, you're supposed to kill, wipe them all out." And Saul had failed to do so. So Samuel intervenes and shows up in 1 Samuel 15, jumping to verse 22. Samuel's response is fascinating. He says, and this is chapter 15 of 1 Samuel, verse 22. Samuel says, "Does Jehovah delight in elevated offerings and feast offerings as an obedience to the voice of Jehovah? Behold, to obey is better than choice offering, to be attentive rather than the fat of rams. For rebelliousness is like the sin of sorcery, and verbosity is like the iniquity of idol worship. Because you have rejected the word of God, he has rejected you as king." Now, of course, Samuel is a prophet. What did Samuel just say? So, to obey God's instructions and what he wanted was more valuable than any offering you could give. Because King Saul's excuse was that, well, we save these good animals because they're going to be good offerings for people. Yeah, make God happy. It does make God happy. But what's fascinating is, what did Samuel compare? Yeah, witchcraft and idolatry. Now, that's fascinating. Verbosity, which many words will use stubbornness or try to explain away. So you're trying to rationalize your actions. He compares that to idolatry. What on earth does that mean? You're obeying him or you're obeying you? So in idol worship, I can worship a rock, I can worship a stone, or I can worship myself. In my own stubbornness, my own rationality. Well, I do this, I justify it because of that. Though they're wrong. What did I just do? I put myself over God. I'm right because I say so. I do what is right in my own eyes. I think it's right, therefore I do it. Now, God said it's wrong, but because I think it's right, I argue it must be right, because I see all these facts, I have all these reasons, therefore I must be right. But God said it's wrong. But I'm obeying myself because I think it's right. I am now worshiping an idol, which is me. I am my own idol. All of us have that problem. I've never met a person who does not rationalize their thoughts. We all do it at different times, good or bad. I can't argue it. But we all have this problem. So when it comes to idol worship, you should have no images, no bow down to them. What are we doing when we rationalize ourselves, thinking that, well, we're right and God's instructions really don't matter in this case, or they're incorrect, or some error? What I think is right, I think he really meant to say this. We just put ourselves over him. We're now idol worshipers. We created our own God. And we look in the mirror, that's what it looks like, because it's ourselves. Make sense? So the nature of idol worship is not some abstract, or so not some, it's a long time ago, we don't bow down to rocks and chunks of metal anymore. So idol worship is all gone. No, it's not. It's probably more pervasive today than I think it's ever been. The nature of oneself, thinking that I'm right, that is our idol worship. Just as bad, same thing. So, be aware that idol worship is more extensive today, I think, than it has ever been in history. Because I have yet to run across cultures that bow to God, the real God, bow their will, but rather do their own will. Cultures do their own will. Humans do their own will, regardless of what God said. Great falling away. The concept of great falling away, the idea, is there a God? Or as I think, was it Paul or Peter? I can't remember one of them said that. Man without excuse. There is a God, and you cannot argue there isn't one. You can, but it doesn't mean you're right. So idol worship is an interesting concept. Be aware, it is very pervasive still. Command number three, I'm doing okay on time. That's good. Command number three is not take God's name in vain. This is an interesting concept. Name in vain, of course, obviously is to make it in effect or break down or bring it down or bring it low, bring it common. That's verse 7 of chapter 20. This is also one of the areas the concept of blaspheming God comes from. When you speak evil or curse against him, you brought him as if he is of no value. Of course, that is a death penalty case. That's recorded in Leviticus chapter 24. That is where the gentleman, they have a, I think there's, recall correctly, it is a argument between two men. One's the son of Egyptian dad, but of Israelite mom. He has an argument with another Israelite. They fight back and forth, and the one guy curses God. That breaks the commandments. You just brought God's name low. You brought it down, made it lower than it belongs, set him aside. What do we do with him? Stone him, he dies. That's the nature. It's one of the possibilities of where that instruction comes from. To make something vain, as I mentioned before, to bring it down or bring it down low, it is not quite the same as other words. So you'll note in your Bible's translated as vain. Such, for example, to reek. Not the smell. I'm referring to reek as the Hebrew word reek, which means to pour out or to empty it, to make it on the ground and make it of no use to you. Or the other one is shakir, which is to lie, to make it to desecrate or to deceive in God's name. All of them, of course, are sins. But if you deceive in God's name, if you pour out God's name of make it garbage or bring it down low, all those are unacceptable behaviors that people can sometimes do. But those are all parts of God's instructions to not make his name low or of no value. You could also, of course, read the examples of that in different parts of the Torah. There's another component of that, which, of course, is Numbers 30 and Leviticus 19. We'll jump to Numbers 30 real quick, as this section regarding making his name low. Numbers 30 is a specific category of making his name low. It has to do with vows and oaths. If you vow something, by the way, I should ask ahead, what's a vow versus an oath? To write this down. Any other differences between the two of them? Well, one's an agreement, one's a promise. So a vow is an object, which I promise usually. An object, I will give this thing to God. I will dedicate this house to him. Or some people like, I will vow to teach my children only this way. All those are all vows, things you're willing to do. I think that the object you're dedicating to God. So it's usually an object or a thing of some form, dedicated. Now, an oath is in a slightly different category. Granted, in English, we kind of group them together as the same, but they're really not. An oath is more of a verbal swearing. I swear. Like, for example, have you ever heard the term of swearing in a Bible, or they used to be Bible, some of them use now, in court, that's the idea of taking an oath. So you are agreeing with your words, but you're doing something. So this is swear or to swear something. Swear an oath or an agreement. Now, in Numbers 30, which we're not getting today because it's a totally different Torah portion, it's Matzot, but Numbers 30, it discusses the details of vows and oaths, and God points out that if you make a vow or an oath, I will hold you to it because you made it in my name. Now, if we make a vow or an oath in God's name, as the commandment says, don't make God bring his name low, are you held accountable to it? What if you fail? What if you fail in your vow or your oath? What did you just do then? You brought God's name low. Made it in effect. Not valuable, not important, not held up. Now, this is a common problem amongst cultures in general of saying, yeah, I promise I'll do this, and then you fail to do it later. Now, that's a vow between you and that individual. But when you promise in God's name, which Bathsheba holds King David to, when David's dying on his deathbed and says, hey, wait a minute, you made a vow under God's name that Solomon would be king, not Adonijah, who's now trying to become king. And David, being held that oath, he made it in God's name. He got up out of his bed. Well, sort of. He sat up. He got up out. He was old. 70, not doing so well. Been a long life for him. Sits up and says, "No, I made this agreement. I'm going to hold to it." She brings it to recall in his mind, "You made an agreement." And she says, "You did it in God's name. You're held accountable to this, David. Do something." So King David had to actually do something, as opposed to just passing away and let, you know, God handle it. It didn't work that way. David, you made an agreement. You have to stick with it. So David held it. So David considered his vows, in that case it was an oath, his oaths of great value, as opposed to like somebody like the Romans who didn't. Totally different world. So God's name, you can bring his name low in many different forms. Your hands up? Yes. I wish you just, what?
Little question.
Go ahead.
We always say wedding vow, but is it a vow? Is a wedding agreement a vow or an oath?
That's an interesting point. So in the case of vows, they're a little bit of both. If you look at the text of a vow, wedding vows, when you look at text, what's actually being written out, what's being spoken of, I'll be with you, sickness and health, rich, poor, I've forgotten all of the things there. But the things that are listed there, the actual lists of the sickness and health, those are actual physical things. You were sick or you were healthy, as opposed to what you will do necessarily. So it's a mixture of sick and healthy, of physical things, and then I will be with you is the oral thing, what I'm willing to do for you, an oath you agreed. So it's the wedding vows are a mixture of what we do with vows, sickness, health, rich or poor. What's the other one? Sickness, health, rich or poor. Poor, and there's another one. What's that? Until death is part. Thank you. There's something else. Till death do us part. The important one. So I knew there was in there somewhere. So all those things which you're vowing to agreeing to do in the form of an oath as well as a vow. So it's a mixture of both of them together. So in wedding vows, we group them as vows per se. You look at the texts themselves, actually a mixture of both what you're agreeing to do as well as the circumstances, which are vows, but the circumstances that those agreements are being applied under, which is sickness and poor, health and death and whatever else. It's supposed to be done before God in God's name. That's the nature of our wedding vows we do. Now, if we look at biblical texts, you can't find wedding vows recorded in the Bible anywhere. So that is the wedding vows are a man-created thing. Now, I'm not saying marriage is, I'm saying the wedding vows are. So in the biblical text, if you agree to marry somebody, right there on the spot, you made the agreement and the fathers agreed, say, yes, it's fine. Guess what? You're married. Done. Now, if you have witnesses, it's a contract. It's a business contract. Usually fathers were involved. They actually wrote things down. Now, we don't know what all texts include, but there was contracts written out. And those are physical contracts. And it usually has to do with money. The contracts are, if you ever divorce her, here's the requirement that you will pay for the rest of her natural life. Let's write it all out. And these agreements, if you have a second wife or a third or tenth or a millionth or whatever, how many Solomon had. This is the other thing where you have to agree to stick with these, but what happens? So the contracts are there and we have indication that we don't have actually text of a contract. Do you fight a text of a wedding contract? I don't think I've seen one. I've seen contracts between the different cultures, between the citation of God in them. But I've never seen a wedding contract. So I'm curious what that used to look like. Anyway, modern day, they have those. So in that case, you had an oath and a vow mixed together in the form of a contract. You're putting your money on the line, literally. Your money's written down on the line how much is being paid, as well as the children and what they inherit. Let's see, move forward to the next one. This is obvious. We mostly, this is not too shocking. Fourth is Shabbat. Remember the Shabbat? Of course, this is in Exodus 20. I just lost the page. There it was. Exodus 20. It is to remember Shabbat. Now, of course, I mentioned before. Yes, Anne.
Okay, what about the there is a verse in the vow that we take, a marriage vow. It says, let not anyone turn asunder. Now, isn't that scripture isn't there a scripture about that? You know, where it says,
it might be to join together the tear apart. I'm not, I don't know if actually a phrase that says that. It might be. I don't have the Bible memorized, so I really can't tell you. If some of you do, you can look it up. But I don't know that phrase, let no one turn asunder, is in the, in there somewhere. It might be. I'm not sure. Was that?
Where therefore God has joined together, let no man.
Okay. That's.
For therefore a man shall leave his.
That part is phrase. Yeah. His wife. That part. That's for Genesis. Leave his father, mother, cleave unto his wife. That part is there. Yeah, the whole point of the wedding vow is the idea that God is the witness behind it, because no individual person will necessarily be there throughout your life who is there at your wedding. So, for example, the idea is your parents, they're older than you. So they're making contracts, but eventually they're going to die. Well, the contract is that who can guarantee the parties, the both male, the husband and wife, will follow through with this contract? Yes, Jeff.
Well, that's one thing when you talk about... I guess, promise before God. And then you see in the prophets where they talk about forsaking the wife of your youth. So thus you have, the Lord is bringing this accusation against the people saying, hey, you have turned away. And here I am coming to say, wow, what have you done to this other party of the oath?
That's true. He does. He mentions that quite a few times. And yeah, that's been said multiple times. The agreement is that if God is there as the witness, he himself will hold you accountable to it. Let's forward to the Shabbat. Keep and observe. I mentioned before that when God says he remembers something, remember is always associated with an action. It's not to recall in your head. To remember something, just so you think about it, doesn't mean anything. To call to act. To remember means to call to act. The words of car, to remember to think about it, is always associated when it comes to God as to call and react or do something about what you're thinking about. Just thinking about it isn't useful. It can be in one ear or out the other kind of thing. It doesn't do anything. To remember is to actually do something about it. So this is Shabbat. To remember the Shabbat, you do something about the Shabbat to recall with an action. And of course, in Deuteronomy, which repeats the same command, it uses the term to observe, or which is more accurate, to keep, or to hold on to keep in charge of it, or be watch over it. So the nature of Shabbat is a perpetual thing to act upon what you remember, but also to keep it hold dear to you as keep it of great value. And of course, you move on that to father and mother, which we know these pretty well. There's a topic there which I won't get to today. It has to do with the exiles. In the Father and Father and Mother here, it points out that your days belong in the land that Jehovah your God's giving to you. So in the exiles, they were there in the land for 400 years? No. 40 years of the kings. Almost 1,000 years, not quite 1,000, 900 years or so. But 900 years pass by while they're in the land, and then eventually they're all exiled out and kicked out. So their days were long in the form that they were 900 years long. And eventually, roughly, I'm rounding off exact figures. Roughly 900 years later, your days are now cutting short. They're getting cut off. So that's what happened. So the exiles were kicked out. What does it tell us? Well, God says, honor your father and mother, so your days will be long in the land. And then after 900 years, you are no longer in the land anymore. What happened then? You didn't honor your father and mother anymore. That's as God commanded. So this is the problem. It's an interesting question. So if God removed them from the land, if God removed them from the land, then the reason he removed them from the land, according to this commandment, would be they didn't honor their father and mother. That's what you would naturally conclude. And here's the problem. Actually, not a problem. Here's the actual, I guess, the explanation for it. Which father and which mother did they honor? It's proven because Jeremiah says so. The book of Jeremiah tells them when they're in Egypt, when they have to exile Judah, and Jeremiah says, what are you doing? Why are you offering to the queen of heaven? What's wrong with you? Didn't you know what you were doing in Israel caused this? The Nebuchadnezzar to come and destroy us and remove us out? And they said, but wait a minute. Our fathers have all offered to the king, the queen of heaven. Our mothers have offered the queen of heaven. And our kings have. We've always done this. And Jeremiah says, no, you haven't. You didn't honor your father and your mother. You honored the ones that were doing evil, not the father and mother that were doing good. As a result, your days in the land have been removed. Pretty simple, huh? No, I'm talking about God. The original father and mother with Moses. And Moses, who would be the father, so to speak, of the nation of Israel? Who's the father of the nation of Israel? Well, first of all, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were the three fathers, the patriarchs. So were they worshipers of God, the creator of heaven and earth? Or were they worshipers of other gods? Creator of heaven and earth. So their fathers, meaning Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are the fathers which you would honor. Now, what did the people eventually do? Did they maintain honor the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? So did they honor their fathers? No. See how that works? Just because you honored your biological parent does not necessarily mean you honored your father and mother. What was your biological parent doing compared to what God tells you to do? Because your biological mother or father may have deviated. And their parents may have deviated. Who generations ago may have deviated from what God told you to do. So it comes to honor your father and mother. What does that mean? Well, just honor my parents? I'll treat them well? Okay, yes, treat them well. But what does it mean? To stay in the land long, God with the prophets told them, you were supposed to listen to me, God, with my instructions, my prophets, what I told you to do. Not what your biological mom and dad did. You weren't supposed to follow them. You're supposed to follow the creator of heaven and earth, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's what God told us to do. So who's your father and your mother? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's our father. Well, it'd be Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Those individuals, well, maybe not Rebecca's, or sorry, Rachel's one, you know, sidebar. her indiscretion at one time. But those your father, those are the ones who you would honor. Follow what they taught you to do. And then those ones you would travel out to throughout generation to follow suit. So to honor your father and mother, which father and which mother? Your biological mom and dad that may or may not have done what was right, they had their own wandering path wherever it ended up, or the one that created you? The one that created you, all right? I'm going to have time to run through all of these, so I won't go through all of them too extensively next. We understand murder. I'm not going to go to murder. That's not murder. Yeah, don't murder people. In the case of adultery, of course, obviously the commandment for adultery is usually for male and women, male and females. It's also figuratively for idolatry as far as worshiping the gods too within the text. I'm going to pause a little bit in the form of do not steal. So don't take things that are not yours. There are multiple forms of stealing. There's a stealing that the book of Leviticus discusses, I believe it's Leviticus 19, I think, talks mostly extensively about stealing. In particular, as far as when you steal something, I took whatever possession is, I must pay restitution to it. What did I take plus a penalty on top of that? It varies from 20% penalty to, in some cases, two or three times. If it's sheep, you stole sheep or cows and such. That's a form of how you deal with that payment of stealing. There's also a form of stealing humans. We call it kidnapping today, but you can kidnap someone or steal a person. That's a death penalty case. You are executed for, that's a capital offense. Either you didn't necessarily kill them, but you took them in your possession. You took them as owned them or captured them. It says specifically regarding your brethren, so it's not like you were fighting a war and you captured the enemy. That's the form of sin they're talking about. Capturing somebody who was actually a free person who was not at war with you and you captured them. That's a capital offense, so you were executed when you do so. And you were also not to steal from animals. Shocking, isn't it? You can't steal from an animal either. Exodus 22 discussed that, the whole chapter 22. There's the nature of stealing from animals. What is considered stealing from an animal? What is not considered stealing from an animal? Read Exodus 22. It's the next Torah portion, actually. You have to treat animals also well. So God said, you can't steal from men. You also can't steal from beasts. You won't think about that, but you can. People can steal from beasts. You're not supposed to. So God has rules about how you treat animals and what you can and cannot take from them. So Exodus 22 discusses that. So nature's stealing is not just human to human, it's human to animal too. So all of God's creation, that which breathes, has ownership of things. So don't just take because you have the power to do so. You have to consider what's going on, who you're taking from, and why. And of course, ninth commandment, of course, the false witness. Now this one has two components to it. That is the nature of not speaking falsely towards someone in testimony. There's also the warning God gave to Ezekiel in both chapter 3 and chapter 33 of don't remain silent either. So bearing false witness, you can do two different ways. You can say something that's wrong about somebody else, or you could absolve them and you choose not to. Both are false witnesses. So Ezekiel gives a warning, God gives Ezekiel the warning in chapter 3, and he repeats it again in chapter 33. He said, hey, when you know something, you see something, and you remain silent, that person may die, but as God points out in Ezekiel 3 and 33, I'm holding you accountable for his blood, though, because you didn't speak up. So you know something that can absolve someone. It is your obligation in God's instructions. Open your mouth. You have to say something because it matters. It's repeated as well in the story, which we'll do in 3 weeks from now, Purim. As Mordecai tells Esther, hey, don't remain silent. If you are, yeah, we'll all die, but God will deliver us from some other method. But you yourself, you're going to die for this. So remaining silent is just as bad as speaking evil of being a false witness, okay? It's the nature of faultless witnesses. Okay.
I just want to say, because like there's been lots of times where I felt like, you know, I wish I could say the right thing at the right time, you know, and that, you know, would have helped the situation so many times, you know, and I struggle with that personally. And I just want to bring that up because like with politics, Daniel, you know, it's like, you know, it's a hard thing, you know, to be like biblically correct at the time when you're having a heated political debate with someone, you know?
I'm probably not the best person to talk about that particular topic because I don't like politicians and it's my own personal pet peeve. But if you talk to somebody else who is more self-controlled than I, then you could probably have a good discussion. So I generally don't speak evil of an individual politician, but politicians in general, I don't care for. In my book, if you want power, you shouldn't have it. If you don't want power, okay, you're a possible candidate. And politicians are the always wanting power. So I'm not a personal fan of those who desire power. But I do respect that it is difficult to have self-control in issues like that. And Jeff quite kindly pointed out in last week, where the Proverbs, where there are many words, there is, what's the word? Many words, there is the, what's that phrase? Where there are many words, it was just, I just thought it was many, where there are many words, there's sin or there's a bad, something bad's going to happen. The means keep your mouth shut. Bottom line. I do. I get that. But you and I and everybody else is all responsible when we hear things that are evil to not receive them. Those evil words. We are responsible for that as well. So to not have it come out of our mouth, but with that which is hearing, I mean, I'm not sure where all of you work in your lives, but where I work, the foul language is so intense that one wonders, do they know other words? It's like, can you speak other words? And then sometimes they actually can have conversations for a few minutes. But it is my responsibility to say, yes, I realize the garbage coming out of the mouth is there, but wait until the actual words I can use. And okay, now let's solve this problem now that you've gotten off your expletives. So the nature of, is the person's responsibility to also say, yes, I hear these things, but how do I keep them, separate themselves from entering inside of me? It's not easy, I get that. But that's part of the nature of being someone who follows God and being that example. Yes, Anne.
Well, how do you warn the wicked of his wicked way if you don't say something? I mean, in that particular circumstance, although you know, in the midst of your group of people, I wouldn't dare say something to the whole group. But at some point, you know, one on one, I mean, that's not really, is it not really wicked, or is it, oh, it's okay because it's not that wicked? Or which?
That is an interesting question. And since every scenario is distinct and different, there's no way of answering it with a broad brush statement. So I cannot answer it for you. All I can say is when the situation comes up and God points something out to you, you individually, not to me, but you say, hey, I need to say something about this. Pray about it. And say, God, am I to keep my mouth shut at this time and think about it, or should I open it? Let his mouth, so let his words fill your mouth. That's really all I can say, because the broad brush, oh, you should stand up, or is too often the wrong answer to use that as a blanket statement. So I can't say, speak up. That's usually false. Most individuals that I have dealt with in the past for years are more in the realm of, they tend to know or think there is a God of some form, but they can't tolerate the one they've been taught or understand. So the one they've been taught to understand is not one that I can tell them with words. I can't use my words to teach them or unteach them what they were taught. All I can do at that point is that my coworkers in particular notice I don't talk that way. And they notice that, and they've made comments about that. So they know that not through my words, with my lack of words, they notice. So all I can do, based on me personally, with my personal scenarios, is how do I live my life? Does it look different, or does it look the same? That's all I can tell you, but every scenario is distinctly different. So it's a bit unfair for me to say, you should do this or you should do that. It doesn't work that way. Does that make sense? Hopefully it does. I need to end with the last commandment. Actually, that's not fair. I'll mention the last commandment, but I'm ending somewhere else. The last, of course, is coveting, desire. There's interesting ideas about the nature of do not covet, thou shalt not covet. What do you desire versus what you do not desire? This is not referring to saying, you know what, I need a new car, and it has to be red. Okay, go buy a new car, it means red. Who cares? Doesn't matter. That's not a coveting. Coveting is, Joe Schmooney over there has a new red car. He shouldn't have it. I should have that car. He doesn't deserve that car. Do you know what he did last week? Doesn't matter. I am desiring somebody else's property that God blessed them with, not me. So coveting is the nature of God, of me treating God in the way of God. I was supposed to, I should have, I deserve this, and you have not given it to me. Why not? What is wrong with you, God? I deserve this. I should have it. That's the nature of coveting. I should have something which is not, God's not given to me. There are many things in the world, possessions, people, wives, children, we want better, and we want to improve. We make our conduct better, or teach our children better, or work better, or do something better. That has to do with yourself. Okay, I will try to improve myself. What I can do, what I can control. Or a young man sees a young lady, says, hey, I want to marry her. Okay, go talk to her, or go interact with her, go fight, go court her, do the process. That's not classified as coveting. Because all that is within your possession, within your means to gain if you can. Coveting is somebody else has something that is not permissible to you. It is not available to you. It is not yours. You cannot have it. And that is what you want. That's the nature of coveting. Does that make sense? Okay, so these are the nature of what I point out to you. I'll conclude with this in a few things by it. Go back to Ezekiel 18, which we were there earlier. This is repeated, to honest, it's repeated multiple times. Anytime the Bible repeats something, it wants you to understand and remember it. So this idea of sin, transgression, and all those various other things. Let's go to... you know what, let's not do 18. Let's go to Ezekiel 20 instead. Ezekiel 20. Ezekiel 18 is a subcategory of what I want to end on. So I'm bypassing Ezekiel 18 and go to Ezekiel 20 instead. So Ezekiel 20, let's jump to verse 11 of Ezekiel chapter 20. Verse 11 is, actually, we'll jump back to verse 10 real quick. We'll start at verse 10. I took them out of the land of Egypt and brought them to the wilderness. I gave them my decrees, my laws made known to them, through which if a man fulfills them, he will live through them. I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them, to know that I am Jehovah who sanctifies them. Now, we're discussing this with God gave them commandments and gave them instructions that you will live through. That was the idea. Can you remember verse 13? But the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They did not follow my decrees. They spurned my laws, through which if a man fulfills my laws, he will live through them. And they desecrated my Sabbaths, and exceedingly, so I thought to pour out my wrath upon them in the wilderness to make an end of them. But I acted for the sake of my name, that it should not be desecrated in the eyes of the nations before whose eyes I had taken them out. I also raised my hand in oath against them in the wilderness, not to bring them in the land that I had given to them, a land that flows in milk and honey, a splendor for all lands. All this because they spurned my laws and did not follow my decrees. They desecrated my Sabbaths because their heart kept going after their idols. But my eye pitied them rather than destroying them, so I did not put an end to them in the wilderness. I said to their children in the wilderness, do not follow the practices of your fathers and do not observe their laws. Do not defile yourselves with their idols. I am Jehovah your God. Follow my decrees, observe my laws and fulfill them. Sanctify my Sabbaths and they shall be a sign between me and you, for you know that I am Jehovah your God. The children of Israel rebelled against me. They did not follow my decrees. They did not observe my laws to fulfill them, through which if a man fulfills them, he will live. And they have desecrated my Sabbath, so I spoke to myself to pour out my wrath upon them, to spend my anger on them in the wilderness, but I restrained my hand and acted for the sake of my name, that it not be desecrated in the eyes of the nations before whose eyes I had taken out them out of. If you notice in this section, it's the nature of God is pointing out that there's a lot of citations here focus on the first few commandments of his Torah. The Ten Commandments, first 10. The first few of them, he focuses on the fact that they chose to abandon or not follow. He points out, though, if they follow them, they will live. That is a concept our Torah teaches us. It's recorded in Leviticus 18. If you follow these commandments, you will live by them. This is how you will live your life. The nature of God's commandments are not to give us, you know, salvation of heaven. It's how you live, how you exist, how to survive. God repeats it also in Deuteronomy 4, repeats it in Deuteronomy 18, as well as Deuteronomy 30. He repeats it over and over and over and over again. Those who live by my laws, they will live. So we live by God's laws, we live. And of course, Deuteronomy 30 points out, there's two ways. Choose. There's a way to live by God's laws, God's instructions, choose that path, or choose the other way, death. But Moses points out in Deuteronomy 30, it's right in front of you. You choose. Which way do you wish to follow? Choose what God chose, what God designated for us, or choose the other path. But if you wish to live, choose the path that God gave. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments? Conclude with a prayer then. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for the Shabbat day of rest. Thank you for teaching us and showing us what is good and right and fair in your eyes. Please guide us the rest of our Shabbat, Father, our time we have with one another. Thank you for being kind to us. Bless us, Father, we praise you in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.